On Tech News Today, the Ashley Madison hackers just dropped a whole bunch more data, and this time they've got the company's email. Plus, Mercedes might do a joint venture with Apple or Google to build a new car. And we'll show you the live-action first-person shooter zombie fest that stunned Chat Roulette. It's all coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, August 21st, 2015. This episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? At ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with a journalist who report it. My name is Mike Elgin, and our co-anchor today is Mashable senior tech correspondent Christina Warren. Hey, Christina, how you doing?
I'm good. I'm in sunny Los Angeles, although it's a little overcast today.
Yeah, it actually does happen. It could be smog. Check carefully. Now, you're there for another Taylor Swift concert, which leads to the question, what's the matter with you?
That is the question. But as my friend Liz would say, WWATD, what would a teen do? And that is what the question I asked when my wonderful friend Stephanie Booker invited me to come to LA to go to the concert with her. And I said, what would a teen do? And this is what a teen would do. A teen would spend a ridiculous amount of money on an airline ticket with 2 days advance notice and fly to Los Angeles to see Taylor Swift on Saturday.
The only difference is a teen would spend their parents' money and you're probably spending your own. So that's
you're dead on. You're dead on. You're exactly right. One of my colleagues made the same joke, and you're right. That is what a teen would do. But as I pointed out on This Week in Tech, I am, you know, dual income, no kids. So it's kind of like it's my parents' money. I mean, it's my money, but, you know, I'm paying for my teenage self.
Yeah, somebody's got to. Now, we had a quick controversy. I think it's subsiding at this point, but Spotify rewrote their privacy policy. Lots of people freaked out, including famous people freaking out on Twitter. And now the CEO has issued an apology, promised that all this data that they would be harvesting would be opt-in only. But I think the controversy should remain because of the things that Spotify wants to give itself permission to grab. What's your take on this?
I actually have a slightly different take on that. I think that what they're wanting to ask for makes a ton of sense. I mean, they're saying they want access to your camera roll so that you can share photos. That's a pretty common thing. They're not wanting to actually scan your photos. They want access to contacts. That one gets a little bit creepier because, yeah, they claim it's because they want to build a social network. Really, it's because they kind of want to spam you and add your usual contacts, you know, to one another's sites. The same thing, I think, you know, where people really get kind of freaked out is their listening history, is their location especially. Is that sort of stuff going to be mined and sold? And so far, I think Spotify is doing a good job of answering that question. And I think that enough people trust them that they're probably, you know, on the side of no one thinking that they're, you know, in a bad spot. They're going to do things bad, poorly. But you're right. I mean, it is still one of those controversies where it's like, there are some valid concerns. It's unfortunate that Spotify didn't announce this in a better way first.
Yeah. And the other thing that happens in companies is that lawyers draft these things, and lawyers' job is to protect the company against any possibility that might come in the future. They also know that nobody reads these things. They just say, yeah, I read it, and then they move on with their lives. Although in this case, that didn't happen to happen. But, you know, the couple of controversial points is that they give themselves permission to grab your contacts photos. In other words, the pictures of your friends and family, and also media files, whatever that is. Like actually grabbing media files off of your phone, kind of weird.
Weird. And like I said before, I do think that like the contacts thing is pretty not cool.
Yeah.
That's one of those things where I'm like, I don't know about that, guys. That seems a little over the line.
I think that the biggest point to be made about all this, of course, is that their timing is horrible. This is right when Apple Music is coming online and the paid option is like right there. You know, people are going to be making that decision. And they give themselves a black eye right at the wrong time. So bad timing.
Yeah, no, it's a horrible time for them to be doing this. You're absolutely right. This is one of those things where it's like, really, guys, you couldn't have waited to a couple of months for this to subside. And I mean, but ironically, I think part of the reason that this is happening is because they are up against the gun, and they're going, you know, we're not really sure what's going to happen going forward. We've got to try to make our product better. That means, you know, having some of these better features, and that's going to mean we need to have more access to stuff. But the whole thing, you're right. I mean, the messaging just couldn't be worse. I mean, the fact when the CEO has to issue a statement a couple of days later, it just shows that there's kind of it's been a kind of a disaster.
Yeah, it absolutely has. Well, let's jump into the regular news. Censorship justified by Europe's right to be forgotten rules just jumped to a whole new level of crazy. Google has been ordered by UK regulator to remove links to news stories about link removal itself. In other words, the UK's Information Commissioner's Office yesterday extended the right to be forgotten to include stories about the right to be forgotten when it references specific cases. Google was given 35 days to comply. Greg Sterling is a contributing editor at Search Engine Land and joins us to talk about it. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thanks, Mike. Good to be here again.
I'm so glad you're here, and this time with yet another stunning background. Now, how far will European...
I live in a treehouse, Mike.
Oh,
that's
nice.
Why I'm here.
Nice. I envy you. Now, how far will European regulators pull the wool out of this particular sweater? For example, will Google later be ordered to remove links to this week's stories about the removal of links to stories about the removal of links to stories? I mean, when does this end?
Precisely. Wheels within wheels. Well, so I think if we step back, what they're trying to accomplish is the same thing that the French and others are trying to accomplish by getting Google to, by asking Google to remove all these links on a global basis. They want to prevent the circumvention of the right to be forgotten. So that's the intent here. But the execution is very bad. So these media companies, the various media outlets, are upset that their stories are being removed from the index. And I guess that the traffic to those stories is disappearing. So they tend to write these what you might call revenge stories. Our links were removed, and here's what the links were. Here's what the stories were about. And so they're recapitulating the whole issue, and that's what the UK regulator was getting at. You can't talk about the substance of what was removed previously, but it's a big mess.
Now, you know, how do the UK freedom of speech laws work? Do they have laws that protect freedom of speech? And how do any of these European censorship rules override them? How does that work?
Well, I think the Europeans would object to the notion that this is censorship, although we tend to take a dimmer view of it
Sure.
here in the US because our laws are more expansive. Across Europe, Western Europe at least, there are speech is a value that's protected. And there are legal protections to varying degrees. I'm not intimately familiar with all the laws across the EU, but that's a value that is protected and vindicated almost uniformly. But they see this as a much narrower thing. This is not an attack on speech. This is the right of individuals to – this is the privacy rights of individuals. So they place a much – you know, you talked just a second ago about the Spotify stuff, and Spotify is a European company. But the Europeans in general, at least from a governmental standpoint, are placing much more of a premium on individual privacy than they are on speech here. So it's a conflict between the two values.
So the American Library Association defines censorship as the change in the access status of material made by a governing authority over its representatives. Such changes include exclusion, restriction, removal, or age/grade level changes. This is censorship, as far as I'm concerned. They may disagree. And, of course, it is, of course, designed to protect the privacy of individuals. This reminds me of a case we reported yesterday where Danish police arrested two men for running two Popcorn Time-related websites. There was no infringing content. There was no code. There was no nothing. There was just news and information about essentially a torrent client. And they were arrested in Europe for speech. Now, what these two things have in common is that the stuff that's being censored is legal on other media. You can put all this stuff into books. You can put it on magazines.
Yeah.
And their argument is, oh, but the internet is so easy to access. It's so widely distributed.
Yeah, this,
it's like it's okay to burn books as long as they're bestsellers.
This is the problem, is that the underlying articles themselves are not removed or not in any way, prevented from being published. So you can, it's about the distribution and dissemination of the information, which is very weird still in my mind. This is all focused on Google in particular. It's about the Google index with a tacit kind of recognition that if it's not in Google, it doesn't really exist, or at least that's the implication. And I tend to be sympathetic to your view, Mike. I really think that this is, if not borderline, if not censorship, then very, very close, because it's going to chill these media companies from writing about these incidents in the future. And it effectively makes it verboten to publish a story, or at least to have a story distributed on Google that talks about an individual who was successful in his or her removal request, when you identify the criminal or other unpleasant detail in the background. And it's very troubling, I think, in many, many cases.
All right, so let's get down to brass tacks, Greg. What is the UK going to do if Google just refuses to comply, the same way they've basically refused to comply with some of the things that the EU has wanted them to do? What's going to happen then?
Well, you know, I guess the recourse here is to levy fines of various degrees against them. And then I guess it could escalate from there.
So they're going to burst in $10 million, which Google will make up in like 30 seconds.
Well, right. I mean, so that's always an issue with a company like Google, is that they have so much money that conventional fines don't work, which is why in the antitrust scenario, kind of the EU situation broadly, you've got potential fines that could reach, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, where that would not be trivial.
Unbelievable. Greg Sterling is at searchengineland.com and on Twitter at GSterling. Greg, thank you so much for joining us today on Tech News Today.
Thanks, Mike and Christina. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye. Got some really interesting news coming up right after our sponsor message from ZipRecruiter. Now, ZipRecruiter is a great way to hire because they solve and make easy the hard part about hiring. The hardest part about hiring is when you get your job out there, and if you're successful, you know, you're going to get a lot of respondents. Of course, with a ZipRecruiter, you're going to be successful because you can post to 100-plus job sites with a single click. But if you're successful, all these people come back, and then what happens? You got to slog through all these resumes, and it takes you a long time to realize, wait a minute, this person isn't qualified at all. Or, wait a minute, this person is qualified, but for a different position. It's really time-consuming. I've hired hundreds of people in my career, and it's really a pain. But with ZipRecruiter, it's super, super easy. All the job applicants come in, and first of all, ZipRecruiter filters them according to your criteria. So if you basically set it up so that unqualified people who are unqualified in specific ways, then it will filter those people out and you won't get them. The qualified people will come directly into your inbox from all 100 job sites. They all come to the same place in your inbox. You can also use their really cool app for iOS and Android, and you can do your job search on the go. You can use your company logo and colors to make your job pages an extension of your business. It's just so great to get the resumes and the candidates in the way that ZipRecruiter presents them to you. Finally, you don't get the annoying problem of having have to go to site to site to site. Using this one comes from email. That one you have to go to the website. Another one you have to do something else. It's really a pain. With ZipRecruiter, it all comes right to you, and it's handed to you on a silver platter. More than 650,000 employers who have come to the site for help with hiring have gotten great results. Now, we have a user testimonial from a user named and a happy customer named Janet. She said, I was looking for two positions at my marketing agency. I received 100-plus resumes in a month and found most of the resumes to be spot on and well-matched to our request. This is what you'll find, folks. Now, we have filled the jobs and would use ZipRecruiter again without hesitation. And that's what I hear from all ZipRecruiter users, including Twit. We use ZipRecruiter as well. Try ZipRecruiter, you're going to keep using it for all future job boards. It's like flying a business class. It's so hard to go back to coach, but with ZipRecruiter, you don't have to. You can fly business class for the rest of your career. Today, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT, ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. The Ashley Madison hackers yesterday released another pile of data from the adultery hookup site, and this one is twice the size as the first one. Lily Hay Newman is a reporter for Slate and joins us now. Welcome to the show, Lily.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. The so-called Impact Team hackers released a 20-gigabyte trove of data. The first one was only 10 gigabytes. What's in this new trove?
So this one seems to be mostly source code for Avid Life Media products, websites, apps, things like that. And then also seems to have an archive of the Avid Life Media CEO's emails, though people have been having trouble getting it open. It seems like it may have been corrupted in the archiving process.
So, this is interesting that this is now more akin to what the Sony hack was, which was revealing more about the corporate side of the company rather than what the first reveal was, which was obviously the users. You mentioned source code to the Avid Life Media websites and mobile apps. Let's talk about this. I mean, do you think that Avid Life Media is going to survive this?
It doesn't look good. They're really being hit on a number of fronts, and I think one of the issues with source code, you know, some sites have been saying, well, this is pretty boring compared to what we had earlier in the week. And, I see why compared to sort of juicy personal details, it might seem like that. But source code is really important because it allows other hackers, not just the Impact Team hackers, to be taking a look at what's going on and identifying even more vulnerabilities in other things besides just Ashley Madison, because Avid Life Media has other properties. So really, you know, hackers could start coming from all angles and just really taking some stuff down, you know, even more than what's already happened.
Now, the hackers wrote a letter, I guess, to the public accompanying this trove. What did the letter say?
So the big thing in this note was, hey, Noel, you can admit it's real now. And Noel is the CEO of Avid Life Media. Noel Biderman.
I love that, I have to say.
So, Avid Life Media has been attempting to stay kind of vague on whether or not these disclosures are real, because as they've said, and it makes sense that it would be true, ever since the Impact Team first said we're going to do this release, which was about 30 days ago, lots of phony troves have been popping up, phony data dumps with imposters saying we have all the data from the site. So they've been trying to kind of keep it uncertain, just hoping that maybe this one isn't real either.
but clearly this one is real. I mean, clearly this one is actually real. And it was clear from the first leak that it was real. I've reached out to them a number of times for comment. They haven't gotten back to me, but I was flying overnight, so I haven't really had a chance to get in on this. Have they released a statement to anyone confirming or responding to this most recently?
I don't think so about this most recent leak, unless I missed something this morning. But in general, I think all the statements I've seen have basically been talking about how this is an illegal act. Right, like hacking their company, releasing these personal data, and that is wrong and illegal, and that they're going to pursue the people who did it, and sort of trying to downplay about the question of the validity of the data.
And of course, we still haven't heard anything about data from Cougar Life, which is one of the sites that this company has. No, it's not a wildlife magazine. Now, Lily, what's your personal opinion on this? I mean, can this company survive this? I mean, who's going to go rushing to this website and sign up now? I mean, it's like, is it over for them?
I think it's really not good. And like I was saying, having the source code out there really makes them much more vulnerable across all properties, because even, you know, trying to build new stuff, you can see from the old source code what their strategies are, what their techniques are. So they'll have to really radically overhaul their corporate strategy in order to really move forward. And I, like you said, I don't know if consumers will be sympathetic to that and, you know, excited about that. But I think that it doesn't mean the end of internet facilitated cheating for, you know, people
sure.
are still, you know, going to want to find what they want to find on the internet. They just might be looking for a company that they feel is more trustworthy.
One comment on that, you know, they were trying to go public on the London Stock Exchange. I don't know about you. I feel like this completely ruins any attempt to them to go public. I mean, I think that that's basically out of the question at this point, especially, I mean, it was bad enough with the user leaks, but I think especially with the company data being leaked, there's no way that they could get any exchange or any backers, frankly, to help take them public.
Yeah, I think it's, like I said, it just really undermines any type of sort of strategy right now that they might have. Like, everything is out there, so and vulnerable to attack. So it's hard to see how you would convince, you know, people in the markets that it's a safe bet, you know.
Well, it's one thing is clear, and that's that the source code to a adultery website redefines the phrase cheat code. At least we have that.
Nice.
Lily Hay Newman is at Slate.com.
Wow. And
you can
wow.
follow her on Twitter at Lily H. Newman. Thank you so much for joining us today, Lily.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, Android's pattern lock screen feature is a convenient way to get past a phone's lock screen without using a password or a PIN. Basically, just connect the dots in a specific way to gain access to your phone. Unfortunately, Android lock patterns may not be all that secure. Eric Lehmer is an associate editor for Popular Mechanics and joins us now. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
It's going great, and thank you for coming on. Now, what's the problem exactly? Why are Android lock patterns insecure?
So it actually has nothing to do with Android or the way lock patterns work specifically. It's basically the same human problem that you have of passwords like password or 1234 are extremely common because people are lazy. And it turns out that the same sort of rules apply to these lock screen dot patterns. So there was some research done by a Norwegian university student, Marte Loge. I'm probably murdering that name. But so she did an analysis of thousands of Android lock screen patterns and basically found what the equivalent of 123 password is for these patterns. For instance, like 50% of patterns start with the node in the upper left corner, and over three quarters start with one of the nodes on a corner. So it's really easy to, knowing that and knowing that people usually use four or five nodes, you can, there's already a pretty low amount of possibilities compared to your average password. But knowing that, you can eliminate so many out of the bat and really boil it down to like a few hundred possibilities for any given phone.
That's really interesting. So men and women differ with how they create lock patterns?
Yeah. So apparently men and women both tend to do four to five node patterns, which is like on the very bottom level of being safe. I think three is the minimum allowed. But men, specifically young men, were much more likely to have patterns with a whole bunch of nodes that were like incredibly complex. So like young nerds, basically.
Wow, that is bizarre. Now, how do you create a lock pattern that's harder to guess? And what advice would you give people who are using these lock patterns?
So some of the ways around it is, I mean, just to avoid some of the most common things, like probably you don't want to start a pattern with the upper left hand node, and you want to use as many different nodes as possible because that increases the total number of possibilities. The other tips are to, if you cross over a lot, it'll make it harder for somebody who's looking over your shoulder to see what you're doing. You can also go into password settings and disable it showing the password when you're actually swiping it in, which makes it a lot more difficult for somebody who might be watching you to see what's going on.
Awesome. That is a great story. And Eric, I want to thank you for coming on the show. Eric Lehmer is at popularmechanics.com. You're new to the publication, aren't you? When did you start there?
Yeah, I started just about 3 months ago, so it's been great.
And I'm sorry, your last name is pronounced Lehmer, is that correct?
Oh, yeah. It's fine. I get all the time.
Okay, so it's Eric Lehmer, and you can find Eric on Twitter at Eric Lehmer. Thank you so much for joining us today, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
All right, take care. The Samsung-centric blog Sam Mobile this morning reported in an exclusive that Samsung is working on an Android tablet with, wait for it, an 18.4-inch display. It's called the SMT670. True, it's true, Christina. And it's internally codenamed Tahoe, according to the Post. The tablet has a giant screen, but mid-range specs. Christina, what's your take on huge tablets? Do you like them or hate them?
I hate them.
Perfect. I love them.
Seriously, Okay, why would you want an 18.4-inch tablet? That's not a tablet. That's a television set.
Right. I want a television set. I was playing around with the Acer Chrome Base, which is a 21.5-inch display. It's not mobile at all by any stretch of the imagination. You have to plug it in. There's no batteries and so on. But basically, I'm looking forward to a few. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go on.
Yeah,
I
okay.
was just saying, this is not mobile, but go on.
Yeah, that's a great point. And in fact, even Mark Zuckerberg, if you recall, said the original iPad wasn't mobile. But anyway, that's another point altogether. But I look forward to the future of desktop computing when it's touch and we don't have to use mice and trackpads and stuff like that. The natural way to interface with a computer will be, as soon as we get used to it, a big sheet of glass with an on-screen keyboard and stuff like that. The problem with this Acer Chrome Base is that it's not a touch user interface for the most part. I mean, it's like, you know, it's an interface designed for a mouse and keyboard. But in this case, you know, Android is designed for touch, and I think this is a great idea.
I mean, I think it's an interesting idea. I do wonder how well Android will scale up to this size, the touch interfaces, because we've seen that it's had some issues on the television. It's worked well in some cases, not as well in others. I'm with you. I do think that the future of computing ultimately will be touch. Obviously, Microsoft believes that too. I think it'll be a combination of touch and also gestures. I think there will be a lot of gesture-driven things, maybe not even necessarily on a screen. I guess my question with this is, I mean, 18.4 inches, this is not portable. This might be, you know, wireless. But this is not something you can really carry around with you, because what you end up looking like, there used to be a guy when I lived in Atlanta who would come into Starbucks every single day, and he would bring with him, and I'm not joking, he would bring his 24-inch iMac, because that was back when that was the biggest iMac you could get, and he would literally set up his iMac outside at the Starbucks and plug it in and work from his iMac at Starbucks. And this is what this reminds me of, is just that, you know, if you saw this in public, you would see someone literally carrying around a television set, you know, a computer monitor. It might be interesting to have, you know, for one place. It could be interesting, you know, for some types of computing things. I wonder why they're even calling this a tablet. I mean, Sony tried to do something like this a number of years ago that was semi-portable when some of the first Windows 8 stuff was coming out. I don't know. 18.4 inches. This is like, just to me, this is just more Samsung playing, you know, Goldilocks and the Three Bears when it comes to their sizes of tablets. Like, they literally will make them in any size configuration you can get.
I think that when they came out with the Galaxy Note smartphone, people thought they were crazy. They succeeded with it, and I think they're going to try it again. They may be crazy again,
yeah,
and they may not succeed with this one. But you can imagine this. For example, here's a use case that you might appreciate. In the kitchen, mounted to the refrigerator.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, something like that would be really great. It's got to be cheap enough, and it sounds like it's going to be.
If it is, I mean, and again, I'm not arguing that. I guess my point is, would the 18 inches be that much monstrously better than 10 inches for the kitchen? Because a lot of people use their iPads in the kitchen. Would it be that much monstrously better than other things? I just don't know. I feel like 18 inches is a really big size. What is interesting about this is that it does signify that, you know, Google and with Android and with Chrome, for that matter, are kind of more merging into that desktop-like space. And this could be one of the first devices that really helps push things into that direction, where we really are doing what Microsoft tried to do with Windows 8, really didn't succeed with, really backpedaled a lot with Windows 10, but really kind of bringing, you know, the full-touch experience to everyday computing.
Yeah, and what about the rumored iPad Pro 12.9 inches? Does that sound like something too big, or is that within the realm of usability?
You know, I mean, I think it's usable. I do think that that's, for me, that's too big. I mean, at that point, though, it's interesting because it's really going to be about the same size as the new MacBook, which is frankly just freaking tiny and very portable. But, I mean, obviously that's something you can still tote around, but it's not going to be one of those things where, you know, I have purses that I can fit, you know, my iPad Air in, you know. Whereas it's going to be a lot harder just for the sheer, you know, length, not so much the width or the weight, to get a 12.9 inch around, because it's not that different from carrying around a laptop, which a lot of people do. But I think, again, it's kind of more of this where the traditional computer is going away and it's being replaced by things like this slowly but surely.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Well, Reuters is reporting that Daimler CEO Dieter Zetsche said in an interview with the German magazine that different types of cooperation with Apple and Google are possible because car makers will need tech company expertise to make the cars of the future. One option, he said, would be joint ventures with Apple or Google to make cars like Apple cars or Google cars. He ruled out the idea of Daimler becoming a contract manufacturer to build cars for Silicon Valley, however. We will see, Christina Warren. Do you think that day will ever come when basically the Daimlers and the Mercedes of the world are just churning out Apple cars and Google cars the same way Foxconn does now with smartphones?
I mean, I think that's certainly something. I don't think that that would be their only line of business, but I do think that that's a reality. And then, I mean, if you look at it now, you look at, you know, companies like Ferrari and Porsche and some of the, you know, even Daimler, you know, a lot of these bigger companies are manufacturing for other brands. You know, there are a lot of sub brands. They all share, many of them share the same kind of, you know, drivetrains and engine types and other things. And so I do think it makes sense to have kind of these joint ventures. And I think that what the reality is, and I think this is kind of what the executive was alluding to, is that for these industries to kind of continue to exist, especially as the nature of automobiles changes, they're going to need to have a new wave of kind of, you know, customers, meaning customers that they can build things for. And Apple and Google are great examples and are probably customers that could be very, very profitable for them. So I don't think it means giving up the Daimler brands, you know, like Mercedes and whatnot. I don't think that's going to go away. But I do think that they could be very much, you know, also making things for Apple and Google. I think the Foxconn comparison is actually kind of apt in that way because Foxconn makes things for everybody, you know?
Yeah.
There have been rumors in the past of Foxconn trying to kind of do a house brand sort of thing, and that might happen someday. I mean, I think that they could do that, and it would make sense, and it's certainly something that would keep them in business, especially as the traditional car markets start to shift and change quite a bit.
Yeah. All right. Well, hang on to your butts for this next story, folks. If you needed any more evidence that the patent process moves way too slowly, here it is. The late Apple co-founder and CEO Steve Jobs was granted a patent this week for the iPod Shuffle. Jobs died about 4 years ago. Other notables on the patent are Apple design lead Johnny Ive and Nest CEO Tony Fadell. Nest, of course, is one of the new Alphabet companies. Wow, a little late there, Christina Warren. What do you think about this?
Well, I think what's great about this is this shows exactly how backed up the patent system is.
Yeah, it absolutely does.
Perfect. And one other interesting thing, and I have to try it myself and other people, you know, in the tech media for this too, but it kind of shows that every time an Apple patent is granted or a Google patent or anything else, you know, we rush to write about it as if it's going to become a product tomorrow. And the reality is many times these patents were filed for, you know, many, many years ago. And the fact that the iPod Shuffle patent was just granted to Steve Jobs 4 years after his death is indicative of that. And so I think it's kind of funny that we try to read a lot into patent filings and this shows you really can't do too much of that just because of how that system moves. Some things obviously move faster than others, but this is just a great example of something, a product that's been out for nearly a decade. And, you know, the patent holder has been gone for 4 years. And he's just not getting a patent of it.
Yeah, I think you're right there. Well, a new iOS app called Beep App is designed to enable young people to communicate without older people noticing. It sends out a beep at a frequency that people normally stop hearing when they become adults. Christina Warren, this doesn't really, this is kind of like the Yo app because it doesn't communicate any actual content. It basically just beeps and it's like everybody who's below a certain age can hear it and that's it.
I mean, it's actually better than Yo. I mean, better and worse. Like, it's both dumber and more brilliant. And I didn't know we could get any dumber than Yo, but this is actually kind of brilliant because I can imagine kids in class. This is what I would do if I were, you know, in middle school or high school. I would use this all the time and set up, you know, alerts with my friends and I and just annoy the teacher who might occasionally be able to hear a little bit of something, but also annoy the other students because it would just be really fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Jason's got the example of tones that go up into that register. So let's listen to it. So this is 8 kilohertz, 12 kilohertz. 15 kilohertz. If you can hear this, you're probably below 40. 17.4 kilohertz. If you can hear this, you're probably below 24. And so on. So I didn't hear the last two. How about you, Christina?
Yeah, I didn't hear the last one.
Okay. They're perfect. It's spot on. Well, we told you yesterday that Project Ara, Google's modular smartphone platform, was delayed and that the team was replacing the magnetic system for attaching modules. All that is true. But the reason for it, which we gave, which is that the smartphone modules came apart when the phone was dropped, turned out to be false. It started with the official Project Ara Twitter feed, which announced the redesign of the way modules would be connected. And they used the hashtag #FailTheDropTest. A couple hours after yesterday's show, the Twitter feed said the hashtag was a joke and the system didn't cause the phone to come apart. They're redesigning the way modules connect simply because they've invented a better system. You can't joke about that stuff. Google, come on, man.
No, you can't joke about it. People, especially not with hashtags, but people will take that stuff seriously. Yeah.
They absolutely will and did, present company included, me. All right. Well, in news you can lose, a UK film company called Realm Pictures created a zombie-themed first-person shooter game that they sprung on surprised chat roulette users. It's not game CGI. The game is performed live by actors and stunt professionals, and typing in commands control the action. Even the sound effects were performed live, like old-timey radio shows. Here comes the video.
Okay, Batman, I need your help. What should I do? Come on, just type start.
That's what I want to do.
So it looks like a first-person shooter, but it's video.
You're in control.
And chat roulette users are in the upper left-hand corner.
What
they look confused.
What the hell is going on?
There's a body on the floor.
Okay.
And the door's locked. What should I do?
Is there any way you can get up to the top, though?
In other news, chat roulette still exists, Christina.
This is my point. I was going to say what's truly shocking to me is that there are still people using chat roulette.
Oh God,
it's unbelievable.
I mean, this is cool, but this is really cool. But people still use chat roulette. That's wow. Okay.
Yeah, incredible. Right. Yeah, so we're going to skip ahead here now. This is a lot like a first-person shooter. It looks just like a first-person shooter. What's interesting about this? And that, the game objects, he just picked up a gun. There are actually some parkour and like hardcore stunts that they're performing live for the individual chat roulette user. I mean, it's really elaborate what they've done here.
Do we still have the crowbar?
All right, so zombies are coming through a garden, and now they're in some kind of weird church or something like that.
And then he'll be our friend.
Yeah. Anyway, there's zombies around. It's a zombie first-person shooter performed by live actors. And the chat roulette people, they were expecting something a lot worse, I'm sure. It's incredible. Incredible. All right. Well, you can check it out yourself. The link is in the show notes. Our TNT fan of the day is Elliot Kovacs, who was the subject of these pictures posted on Twitter. Elliot was in the Brick House yesterday and watched the show live. Jason, do you know how old he was? I don't know how old he is. He's a kid. And he also got a chance to sit at the TriCaster, and there he is, controlling everything right there. Future Technical Directors of America. He's the president. Great kid, too. He had questions for everybody. He was grilling Padre before know-how. I mean, it was really...
That's awesome.
We not only acquire audience members, we create them. So that's what we do. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. Christina Warren, besides watching concerts in LA, what are you up to these days?
The concerts are really my big thing happening right now. I'm going to see Heart tonight and Taylor Swift tomorrow. But I'm also working on a piece about Carly Fiorina's record at HP, as well as more stuff on Ashley Madison.
Wow. And have you already started researching Carly Fiorina's record?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. She was an interesting thing. I covered her heavily when she was the CEO. And she was an unpopular CEO internally.
No, she was very unpopular, and I was in high school when she was named CEO, and in college when she was ousted. And I remember I followed that whole thing, very avidly. I'm sure I've read many things you wrote on the topic, and it's interesting to kind of go back, a decade and a half, and kind of relive some of that stuff and see how reality maybe jibes with some of the things that she said. But certainly internally, she was very unpopular. I mean, they're former HP employees that I've met over the years who, you know, you mentioned her name, and I think the only person who gets maybe as poor of a response is if you say Gil Emilio to someone who worked with him at Apple.
So a couple of facts about her that are interesting, curiosities more than anything else. One is that they selected her through this amazing test that they gave to all the candidates. She wasn't really a CEO person, like she didn't have a background as a CEO, and she just aced this test of leadership and so on. The second fact that's really interesting about her is that she, like Steve Jobs, is a pure creature of Silicon Valley. She grew up in Palo Alto School District. She went to Stanford, and as CEO of HP, she was, you know, which is headquartered in Palo Alto. All of those things,
and which is a perennial Silicon Valley company. I mean, frankly, yeah, you know, HP kind of made the valley.
They kind of did, and all of those things. Her where she went to high school, where she went to university, and where she worked as CEO are all within like a 1 mile radius. I mean, just like she didn't move, she didn't budge. It all happened right there for her. Anyway, fascinating figure. I'm looking forward to your article on that. And I thank you for calling today. We'll see you next week.
See you next week. Thanks, Mike.
And have fun at Hart and Taylor Swift.
I will. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. You can subscribe to Tech News Today on Spotify if you can handle their privacy policy, or you can choose your favorite way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. You can also watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1700 UTC at twit.tv/live. You can also join our Tech News Today Google Plus community. Just go to the community area and search for Tech News Today. And you can follow me at elgin.com. Don't miss our other Tech News show, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific every single weeknight. And that is the Tech News Today. This show is produced by Jason Cleanthes and edited by Kevin King. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.